this is 7 minutes of caution, verging a bit on scepticism, and it precedes what I'm sure will be lots of enthusiasm. And I'm not sure why the organisers wanted to put caution at the beginning, but they've done it, and so they're getting it. I want to remind you of a case some years ago, which, if you're old enough, you'll remember, of Dennis Nilsen, who was a serial killer, and who was in the Old Bailey, charged with a number of murders. And there were three psychiatrists who gave evidence in his trial in relation to whether he should be given to manslaughter or murder. And the Crown psychiatrist was asked whether he had an abnormality of mind, and he said he is statistically abnormal, meaning merely statistically abnormal. The defence psychiatrist was a psychoanalyst and said, of course he's abnormal, let me tell you the story. The other defence psychiatrist, Dr. James McKeith, one of my mentors, said, it depends what you mean by abnormality of mind, which was a very thoughtful observation. Because what he was saying is, what does the law mean by abnormality of mind? Because it may not be the same as what I mean by abnormality of mind. And what does diminished responsibility mean? Because I'm a doctor and they never trained me in that at medical school. To many, the nature of Nilsen's offending behaviour itself suggested not just statistical abnormality, but also pathological abnormality, and his mental pathology was the subject of the trial. But what if Nilsen's brain had been shown to be abnormal, either by way of inherent difference or by way of damage or degeneration? And I think the two are very different in terms of possible implications for policy and law. But what if his brain in some way or other was abnormal, had been abnormal? Would that not have, so to speak, clinched the issue? Would he not automatically have been, so to speak, diminished? Or would he merely have been statistically abnormal as regards his brain if the brain abnormality was simply inherent difference from other people? The historical context of this is that there's been a resurgence of neurobiological research on aggression within the context of a growing contribution of the neurosciences to the understanding of complex behavioural traits and behaviour generally. Coincidental with violence being increasingly seen as internationally as a major public health problem, and with society becoming increasingly risk-averse. So as description of the biology of some perpetrators of violence becomes increasingly sophisticated, including developmentally, is it inevitable that the courts will begin to incorporate such knowledge as evidence, and that legislators will, so to speak, do the same? However, recognising that efforts to understand aggression from a biological perspective have a troubled history, evoking images of the Italian school of criminal anthropology, bumps on heads that infer certain sorts of behaviour, and names like Lombroso, and the eugenics movement, with the misappropriation of biology to provide rationale for oppressive social policies. So one should approach this whole topic, I think, with some caution. A liberal will properly want to understand what is wrong with somebody and reflect it in the justice system. The difficulty is that sometimes that difference can be, so to speak, turned on its head and made to have illiberal implications. What would be a criminal legal wish list of questions? Well, it might be something like this. It would be helpful to know from neuroscience, the assistance of neuroscience, whether the defendant intended to do what he did, or in determining the degree to which his urges are resistible, or otherwise assisting in relation to determination of responsibility, or assisting in determining memory, or whether the defendant is lying. Now, the last two are very different from the preceding ones, because the preceding ones might be called high-order concepts. Responsibility is a very high-order concept. Memory is, so to speak, almost a thing in being that you can try to measure. There might also be interest in the genetics or neuroimaging, which might help in predicting violence and suggesting forms of treatment to reduce risk or to predict treatability. So it boils down to two big issues, one determining culpability and the other predicting and preventing reoffending. However, whilst there's an understandable scientific drive towards understanding brain function, including in relation to violence, even if science may develop so as to demonstrate correlations of particular genes or types of brain state with aggression or violence, could that ever necessarily or reasonably infer diminished or absent criminal culpability, or, in a very different domain, justify preventive detention? A summary of current state of knowledge, which I'm sure is going to be given by others far better than I can, is that as follows. Neuroscience is, I think, increasingly identifying associations between biology and violence. These appear to offer the courts evidence relevant to criminal responsibility and the risk of violence. However, if you leave aside the multiple methodological scientific problems in all of these studies, particularly in brain-related studies, given that the brain may be in particular states when its owner decides, so to speak, to be violent, what is cause and what is effect? What is cause and what is mediation by the brain? These become questions of philosophy, perhaps. However, in a sense, more fundamentally, as practically relates to our consideration, what I would suggest is that there's a mismatch between the many different questions which the courts might wish answered by biology and those questions which neuroscience is capable of answering. And this is exemplified by the fact that mental disorder occurs in law in a variety of contexts using a variety of constructs. So, for example, the constructs will be different in relation to criminal exculpation, preventive detention, mental health legislation, or civil incapacities. The law essentially makes up concepts in an abstract artifice fashion for its own justice purposes, and there's no reason at all why they should necessarily reflect science or medicine. That is, in law, there is no real mental disorder, only various abstract definitions of it adopted for different legal purposes, which usually have little or no basis, as I say, in medical or scientific constructions of mental disorder. And failing to recognise this would pose a risk to the proper exercise of justice and to civil liberties. Exercise of justice in terms of responsibility, civil liberties in terms of banging people up on the basis of preventive detention. Since addressing moral or legal responsibility may properly utilise scientific data, but then require entry into an entirely different thought domain. And I'll slip the next bit, just for brevity. So some conclusions. Psychiatry or neuroscience may be able to describe abnormalities in mental functioning in their own terms, but that is not to answer questions about legal responsibility or to justify preventive detention. Scientific explanation is just that, and legal attribution of responsibility or justification of preventive detention is also just that. To attempt to go from science in being to law in the abstract involves a journey for which there is no map, and which may not even exist as a journey. Put in very succinct terms, as a colleague of mine, Colin Campbell, and I wrote in the article that's on the screen, law largely asks questions which science cannot answer, while science answers questions that the law largely does not pose.